This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. You'll also find us online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in. Writer Sukhetu Mehta was born in Calcutta. He grew up in Bombay and in New York City. He's lived in other cities as well, London and Paris and Iowa City, which he will tell you is not really a city. Some years ago, he and his wife, who was born in Madras and raised in London, returned to India to live in its gateway city, the city known today as Mumbai. Mehta returned after an absence of 21 years. When he left the city in 1977, he was a boy, and the city was called Bombay. Mehta is the author of Maximum City, Bombay Lost and Found. His position of one who is at once insider and outsider serve the reader well as he describes the city. He describes the difficulties of day-to-day life for himself and his family as they try to adjust to the city of 14 million people. That's just the beginning, however, as Mehta shows us the challenges facing those much less fortunate than his family, villagers who move to the city in search of a better life but wind up living on the street. Mehta also shows us the criminal underworld and the world of Hindu gangs. He introduces us to the life of a bar dancer and a look at the workings of Bollywood, all in one book that has been critically acclaimed, a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and the winner of the 2005 Kiriyama Prize. Listeners, Sukhetu Mehta is our guest in this portion of the program, and I invite your questions and comments for him. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. Sukhetu Mehta is a fiction writer and journalist based in New York. Maximum City, Bombay Lost and Found is his first book. It's now available in a paperback edition from Vintage Departures. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Mr. Mehta, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks so much for having me on your show.
What led you back to Bombay?
It was very simple. I wanted to see if I could go home again. I had left a city called Bombay when I was 14, and I had spent 21 years wandering around in the cold countries of the world. I wanted to see, when my second son was born, whether it was possible for me to go home again and for my children to have, at least for a short period in their lives, the experience of growing up in a country where everybody else looked just like them.
Mm. And how long did you live there in Bombay once you returned?
I spent 2.5 years researching my book, and then I grew so obsessed with the city. I had a manuscript of some 1 million words that I knew that I had to leave the city in order to write about it from a distance. Mm. So we came back to New York, and I rented a studio in Brooklyn, and I spent another 4 years toiling over this mass of stories that I had, and then it came out with a book. So I could only really go back to Bombay and spend any real length of time there after I had gone away once again for a few years to reflect on the city.
Yeah. Your feelings for the city, have they changed over the years you spent doing the reporting and writing of this book?
Well, it's a very passionate love affair with the city. And as with all passionate love affairs, it's equal parts hatred and devotion. I love the city for the hope that it gives to people all across India. I love the city for its incredible heart, its hospitality to the outsider, the migrant. I love the city for its alchemical magic of everyday existence, the generosity with which it shares its stories. And I hate it for what it does to human beings. Mm. I hate it for its incredible overcrowding. I hate it for what it does to children, especially on the streets of India's richest city. I hate it for the easy impunity with which politicians and criminals flout the law.
Yeah.
So it's a very complex mixture of emotions that I have about the city, but I'm obsessed with it.
Yeah. One of the things a man told you while you were in Bombay, living in Bombay, a man living in a slum told you, Bombay is a bird of gold. But he's homeless.
Right.
He's homeless or living in a slum.
Well, he was living in a slum without running water, without a toilet. His brother had just been shot dead by the police in communal rioting. And he's living there in his mosquito-infested hut. And he says, Bombay is a bird of gold. And I said, what do you mean? It doesn't look like it's that golden for you. He said, no, nobody ever starves to death in Bombay. Money is just flying all around you. For him and all these millions of people that come from the villages of India to live in the slums of Bombay, Bombay is really the land of opportunity where the streets are paved with gold. It's a place where they can make enough money to send back to their families in the village. And the villages of India have been absolutely devastated by the impacts of world agricultural policy. When it is cheaper, when American cotton is cheaper on the world market than Indian cotton is, because of the vast subsidies given, for example, to American cotton farmers or European dairy farmers, when agriculture becomes absolutely unviable in Indian villages, then what Indian farmers and their children do is they take the first train to cities like Bombay and they join the ranks of the swelling shanty towns. Even though it is physically unpleasant in these places, they have created community networks in the slums and they still make enough money to send back to the villages and have the hope of really enriching themselves to the point where one day they will buy a proper apartment in the city.
And what's the likelihood of that?
It happens for some people. In fact, I followed in my book one such family which, for the first time in three generations, moved out of the slums into a proper one-bedroom apartment. And they did this because the children had done well. One of them did well in technology. So Bombay is being enriched by all these call centers and software centers which are growing in Indian cities. And they're like basketball or jazz is for the inner cities of America. Technology is a way for these people to come out of the slums and actually move into the middle class. But that's happening as well. There is movement into the middle class.
Yeah. So globalization has had adverse effects for India and positive effects.
Exactly. It's a very mixed bag. So while India will soon have the world's largest middle class, it currently has the world's largest underclass. Malnutrition rates in India exceed those of sub-Saharan Africa. 40% of the country is illiterate. But still, we hear about India, the economic miracle. It's, last year, it had the fastest growth rate of any large country in the world. It's gotten to the point where Americans feel threatened by the export of not just low-paid but high-paid technology jobs to India. So it's such a large country that everything that you can say about it is true and false at the same time, somewhere in the vast country.
Yeah. You know, it seems to me that we've seen a fair number of books lately on India appear on bookshelves in the U.S. Some weeks ago, the economist Narendra Jadhav was a guest on this program, the author of the book Untouchables, about his family's experience of the caste system. Is there a growing interest in stories about India, both for Indians and for others, Americans, Europeans?
I believe so, Celeste. And I think one of the clearest signs of that is that my book's done well. When I went to American publishers with a proposal for a book about Bombay, many of them weren't very interested. They thought it might be something for the university presses to handle. But I did find enough interest so I could get the funds to write over 7 years a nonfiction book about India. since it came out, it's been on the bestseller lists in India, and it's received attention in a whole number of countries. I just sold rights in Hebrew and German. And I think it points to a tremendous hunger on the part of the world to know about this country, which is going to, along with China, dominate the 21st century. And there's been a lot of really good Indian novels, you know, Salman Rushdie and Vikram Seth and Arundhati Roy, any number of Indian novelists who have been writing in English and whose books have sold well. But there haven't been that much nonfiction. And I think this is about to change. There are some excellent reporters in the country. And if they are given book contracts that give them the economic luxury of spending several years on a nonfiction book, then you'll see a lot more books like mine coming out.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I think is so wonderful about your book is that the stories are so human, and at once they are foreign and familiar.
Well, I wanted to write the story of the big city of Bombay through the little stories of people in its worlds, high and low. Now, I was trained at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. I have an MFA in fiction, and my background really is that of a fiction writer. Then I became a journalist, but I've always believed that I should, in a nonfiction book, write about my characters with all the respect I would give to them as if they were characters in a novel. That is, have them fully rounded out, give them the latitude of their humanness, and not censor anything, and also detail my own interaction with them. It's not an objective book. Mm. It's a story of a passionate love affair with Bombay. And I've been writing short stories, and the other book in my contract is a novel. But I like to think that this book has the narrative drive of a novel, because that's the great nonfiction writers that I admire, such as Joseph Mitchell and A.J. Liebling, wrote about New York City in the same way, with that kind of fictional immediacy. Even though there isn't anything that's rounded out in my book, or there's no composites, I don't use any of the tricks of the novelist's trade in that way. Every single sentence in there that's in quotes has actually been said by a character. But within that, the stories are so fascinating that all I had to do was really try to present them in all their complexity and not make any personal judgments of my own.
Yeah. Were you surprised at how candid people were with you?
I was. I'd been working as a journalist in America, where people are much more reticent about sharing intimate details of their lives. Now, in India, when you go into a railway compartment, the first thing people will ask you is, are you married? How many children do you have? They'll ask you the most shockingly intimate details of your life, and then they will share theirs. There is that kind of generosity in Bombay, where I could walk into a crowd, and within half an hour, I could get any number of people telling me their stories. Now, some of the stories people told me were absolutely mind-boggling. They told me how they had gotten away with, literally, murder. I spoke to murderers who were on the run from the police. I sat in police stations and watched them torture people. And if they shared with me, knowing that I was sitting in the back of the room, tapping away on my laptop. So they were under no illusions about what I was doing. But either they didn't know quite what a book was. I wasn't writing for a newspaper, so it wasn't immediately of danger to them. Or they just wanted somebody to bear witness to their lives.
Mm. Because, in a sense, the city is so crowded. At once, you are so proximate to the next person, but yet you are one of millions.
Well, that's the thing. The last chapter in my book is called The Self and the Crowd, and I became fascinated by the ways in which people managed personal and public space in Bombay. And I found that, the crowd is fascinating. A crowd can be a source of tremendous solidarity. It can be a recreated village in the anonymity of a big city. Or it can become a really menacing entity, which magnifies all our worst impulses. And in the case of a communal riot, where we lose all our individuality over humanity, and impelled by the fury of the mob, can attack completely innocent people. And I spoke to people who, in their private life, you know, one-on-one, they're really good, kind, decent people. But when they become part of a crowd of people fighting for the honor of a religious community, they're capable of absolute savagery. So it is an incredibly crowded city, but because it is crowded, it is fascinating territory for a writer, because it's a city of extremes.
Yeah. One of the very striking things about this city is its population, and 14 million, and you say that two-thirds of the city's population lives within 5% of the total area of the city.
That's right. It is some of the worst urban planning we have seen in any large city. Bombay suffers under the grip of something called the Rent Act, under which rents were effectively frozen at 1944 levels. So if you see South Bombay, some of the most desirable parts of the island city have been locked up by people who've stayed in these very large apartments and have passed tenancy on to their heirs. There is very little new construction going on in the city, at least in the south of the city. And in the north, where there is new construction, it's very badly designed. There are very few roads, parks, schools, all the public conveniences that we take for granted in western cities, in cities of the developed world. It's watching the story of urban planning in Bombay and its political implementation is like watching a disaster movie unfold. And it does a tremendous disservice to the imagination and the hearts of the people who are actually living in the city.
Yeah. Well, tell us about your father and his rule for selecting an apartment to live in.
Well, my father always said that you should be able to, when you look for an apartment, you should look for one in which you can change your clothes without needing to shut the blinds. Now, if you follow this rule, you'll make sure that there's sufficient air and light and privacy, because you'll be changing your clothes without drawing the blinds. Now, in most of Bombay, it's impossible to get an apartment to my father's specifications, mm-hmm. because you are hemmed in on all sides from people, and construction is so haphazard that if you buy an apartment, you have no guarantee that another apartment building won't spring up in the very next year, blocking your view and your light and your air.
Yeah. And in the building that you found a flat, there were 20 floors, 10 flats on each floor. Each flat you describe as having an average of 6 residents and 3 servants. So 2,000 people living in that building, 2,000 people living in the building adjoining your building, another 2,000 in the one immediately behind.
Yes, this was the complex of buildings I had grown up in. It was like growing up in a small vertical city. And this is one of the most desirable parts of Bombay. It's an area called Nepean Sea Road, which when I was growing up there, was at the bottom of a hill, Malabar Hill. And I remember roller skating down the lanes of Malabar Hill and going down bicycles as boys. Now, I can't imagine anybody doing this at any hour of the day or night, because not only have the people swamped the city, cars have swamped mm-hmm. the city. The city is going on a mad road-building binge. There are expressways that lead into the central city, but there are obviously no new roads in the central city because it's been so overbuilt. But the number of cars have multiplied exponentially as cars have become cheaper in the country as a whole. So every one of these apartments now will have at least 2 cars. There's a mad scramble over parking space. In fact, I almost got into a fist fight over somebody who had appropriated the parking space allotted to me in my building. So I say in my book that the wars of the 21st century will be fought over parking spaces.
Our wealth is killing us.
Yes, yeah. And in Bombay this is painfully apparent, yeah. Where people escape from places where poverty is killing them to a city where wealth is killing them.
Mm. One of the things you tell readers early in the book is that Bombay is all about transaction. What do you mean?
Well, Bombay was a city built on trade. It's a port city. It is a place where people buy and sell with tremendous zest. After the city was bombed in 93, there was a series of 10 serial bombs. The day after it was bombed, the stock market opened and shot to new heights. And it was Bombay's way of demonstrating to the bombers that whatever happened, their instinct, their zest for commercial enterprise would never diminish. There's another kind of war being fought on the sidewalks of Bombay between the what I call the hawkers, that is, the vendors of everything from food to clothes to radios, and the right of the people to pedestrians to walk on the sidewalk. But it is almost impossible to move these vendors because this is where they do their dhanda. This is where they conduct transaction. And at every level of the city, those who understand that Bombay survives on transaction, on buying and selling, on a capitalism in all its forms, or crude as well as incredibly sophisticated. I mean, it's the financial center of India. It's essential to understand this transaction in order to understand the city.
Yeah. Well, give us an example. Tell us about how you and your wife, your family, navigated the city of transaction. What was it like there in your flat?
Well, the flat was really, it belonged to a diamond merchant friend of my uncle. And because of the Rent Act, it was very difficult to find rental housing in Bombay. Once you move in, it's well nigh impossible for the landlord to move you out. So most landlords are extremely reluctant. And there are 400,000 empty apartments in Bombay, empty because the landlords are afraid of renting them out. So we had to look around and find through whatever family and friends we have, everything from flats to gas connection. Now, this transaction that I was speaking about, it's not always a commercial transaction. And I'll give you an example. We wanted a gas connection. There is a government monopoly on the supply of cooking gas. And in the late 90s, the government, there was no piped gas into Bombay homes. You would establish an account with the government gas monopoly, and every month they would roll around this big, bright red gas cylinders to your home. So when I first got there, I went to the government gas office, and I said, I'd like, cylinders of cooking gas. And they said, there is no quota. The quota of gas is unavailable. And I said, when will there be quota? And they said, August. So I said, this is May. You mean we'll have to eat sandwiches until then? And I said, well, do you know a member of parliament? I said, no, why should I? And I said, if you know a member of parliament, they have a discretionary quota of gas cylinders. So you should go to them and try to get a member of parliament to get you a tank of cooking gas. This seemed ridiculously arduous. And I was speaking about it to a friend who said, take my mother. She knows the ways of the gas office. And her mother was this elderly Sindhi lady who came with me to the gas office where there were these women, most of a certain age, so all of them would have children, who were working in the gas office. And she went straight up to them and started wailing. She's got two children. What are they going to do without cooking gas? They need gas to boil the milk. Imagine, you're a mother. And the next day, we had a tank of cooking gas in our apartment. So she didn't, my friend's mother didn't go to the official rules about where I could get quota and, how much money it cost. And she didn't even try to bribe them. She appealed to the hearts of the people sitting behind the gas counter, of the mothers. And one mother understood another and understood that because I had children, I had special claims on cooking gas in the city. So it was really instructional. It was one of my first lessons in how the city operated. There is an official city and an unofficial city, and the unofficial city has its own system of economic exchange, which is not always directly tied to money.
Yeah. It reminds me of stories that we heard about Eastern Europe in the 1970s.
Yes, yes. In fact, India traded extensively with Eastern Europe in the 1970s. We gave them our bad Bollywood movies, and they gave us fighter jets. There was a friendship treaty between Soviet Union and India then. So there was a kind of shortage economy. The country had these five-year plans and would decide what everybody should get, and everything from, you know, cooking gas to private cars.
So it is and was nation to nation, and it's also individual to individual.
Yes, that's right. It's changing very rapidly because now, again, there is this liberalization and, for example, in airlines or cell phones, you now have a choice of maybe a dozen carriers. And it's throwing up a whole new world of choice to the middle-class Indian consumer, those who can actually afford it. But then again, there's a huge population which has been frozen out, which who have their noses to the glass wall where the people inside are eating fancy meals.
Is this sustainable?
It is the biggest challenge facing India as a whole over the next 50 years. In the last 50 years, since independence, what India has succeeded spectacularly well in doing is to actually devolve power. In my book, I call it the greatest transfer of power in world history. The real devolution of power to the real majority of the 1 billion people that live there. For 5,000 years of Indian history, power effectively belonged to the upper castes and classes, to the Brahmins, the Kshatriyas, people at the top of the caste pyramid, and the people who formed the numerical majority of the country, those people formerly called untouchables, and the scheduled castes and tribes. These people had no claim on power. After India got independence, the lower castes and classes realized that by entering the political process, they could actually effectively get political power. And in a city like Bombay, real power is held by the lower castes. On successive election days, I would travel around the city, and I would find that voter turnout in the slums of Bombay would be in the 90s in terms of percentage. And in the richer parts of the city, it would be in the teens. And that's because the poorer people needed to use politics to establish, for example, land tenure or to get water connections to their slums. And the richer people had essentially abdicated politics and could use the power of their money to influence politics. So the difference between the world's two biggest democracies, America and India, is that in India, the poor vote. Now, over the next 50 years, the challenge facing India is, having devolved political power effectively, how does it devolve economic power? I mean, the pie, the economic pie for India is really growing. I mean, India's the economy is booming, etc. But if this large population is consistently frozen out of the fruits of liberalization, if the pie is not divided more equitably, then there's going to be tremendous social unrest.
Speaking of social unrest, let's go back to the early 1990s. Critical to recent history in India, the riots in Bombay of 1992-1993. What happened? What set them off?
Well, the immediate cause was the destruction by a Hindu mob of a Muslim mosque in Ayodhya, hundreds of miles to the north of India. So after news of this the destruction of the mosque spread through the country, there was rioting throughout the country, and Bombay experienced the worst of the rioting. A native of the political party called the Shiv Sena started these riots in which individual Muslims were targeted and in many cases burnt alive. The city exploded in riots. There were three waves of rioting. And in the third wave, the Muslims retaliated through an underworld syndicate called the Dawood Ibrahim Gang, which, funded by Pakistan, planted 10 bombs in the city and killed hundreds of people, both Hindu and Muslim. Now, the reason for the rioting, which was the worst in the city's history at that time, was between Hindu and Muslim. The next kind of social unrest doesn't have to be between Hindu and Muslim. It could be between Maharashtrian, the people indigenous to Bombay, and North Indian, the people, the newer migrants, who now comprise 30% of the city's population. Or it could be between rich and poor. The point is that a city like Bombay every so often needs a periodic eruption, almost to let off steam. And I followed some of the people that participated in the last riots, and I saw what had happened to them over the next few years. The riots for them were politically and economically advantageous. The foot soldiers of the riots, they got rewarded by the parties which came into power. And it was almost like British nobility going and fighting for the king in the Crusades. When they come back, serfs are freed and lower-ranking nobles become dukes and earls. So the foot soldiers of the riots demonstrated their loyalty to the political leaders.
You know, on the one hand, we have this wonderfully hopeful thing going on in that so many people are involved in the political process in voting. On the other hand, there is also this violent way of turning things around.
That's right. It's something you see in India as a whole. This new generation of leaders from the lower castes and classes. The first generation is often illiterate, unscrupulous, often buffoons, people like Lalu Prasad Yadav, who was the chief minister of Bihar, the poorest Indian state. These were people who, they were like the leaders of American machines, especially in the Democratic Party, in places like Chicago, New York, and New Orleans. They brought new immigrants into the political process. And their leaders, the first generation, they were often gangsters. They were extremely corrupt. But they knew how to dispense patronage. They got the street lights fixed. They got widows money. They got people jobs. And in return, they amassed personal fortunes. Well, the same kind of thing is happening in India. And the first generation, because they come from these impoverished communities, the kind of corruption that they engage in, it's interesting. It's often not a personal corruption. It's corruption on a community-wide scale. There was, for example, a senior bureaucrat who was explaining to a writer friend of mine why he had no option to be corrupt. And he said, "I come from a small village in South India where I was the first member of my community to go to college. So now I've gone to college and I've gone to Delhi and it's the seat of power in Imperial India. When I go back, if I do not come back bearing gifts and money for every member of my impoverished community, I will be an outcast. There will be a social boycott of me." And he said, "I am a lump of sugar in an anthill."
This community violence, does it offer insights into community conflict elsewhere in the world? We see a lot of religious conflict in the world.
I think so. You know, Bombay is, in many ways it's unique, but in other ways it is representative of a group of mega cities, which are really the future of urban civilization on the planet. So cities like Sao Paulo, Jakarta, Kinshasa, Lagos, these sprawling urban agglomerations of tens of millions of people, which are have the same kind of characteristics, which is large sections of the city in which there is no effective municipal administration, constant endemic low-level crime and violence, huge sprawling shanty towns. But yet, these cities remain some kind of beacon of hope for the young people of their countries. Now, if you look at drug violence, let's say, in the favelas of Rio or Sao Paulo, it's remarkably similar to organized crime in the Zopadapattis of Bombay. I remember watching the film City of God, that wonderful Brazilian film, and thinking this could all be set in Bombay. I mean, they're fighting over drugs there. Here we're fighting over religion. But essentially, the kind of young people that are drawn into these wars are the same. They're large numbers of jobless, disaffected youth who really don't need any kind of ideology to fight. That is, during the last riots, the people in the Shiv Sena and the Muslims of the gangs, they were fighting ostensibly for Islam or Hinduism. But they could fight tomorrow over something else. They could fight over affirmative action in government jobs, or they could be fighting over water. I mean, there have been periodic riots over the lack of water supply in the slums of Bombay. So all of these large cities have large groups of these youngsters who basically are they are the products of metropolitan alienation. They do not have a large caste structure or the extended family in the village that might have restrained them from the criminal acts. In the city, they are floating. They are young men with a lot of anger who are capable of great amounts of violence, often at tremendous personal risk. There's a kind of nihilism that operates there.
Mm. And at the same time, they don't want to be lumps of sugar.
At the same time, that's right. They don't want to be. They don't want to go back to their villages. You know, these are there's all kinds of young men. There are other young men who are extremely moral, and they get educated often against great odds and pull their families out of poverty. So, because it's such a large city, I mean, Greater Bombay has a population of 21 million people. Really, it's a city that it's impossible to generalize about. But there are all these different sections. And in the end, one can learn lessons from the past. So I believe that the city's police officials, the city's civic NGOs, they've learned the lessons of the 92-93 riots. And there hasn't been another large-scale riot after that. There's been relative peace because they figured out some very effective community policing techniques. What happens these days is anytime there's some kind of small fight in the slums, or there is something called a Mohalla Committee, which is the neighborhood committee, where respected people from the Hindu side and the Muslim side and representatives of the youngsters are all summoned to the police stations, where together with the police, they thrash out the differences before it can become a bigger conflagration.
Hmm. How do the courts operate?
Well, this is one of the biggest reasons that the gangs flourish in Bombay. There is a kind of judicial paralysis in India. India has the world's biggest backlog of court cases. There's one court case pending for every 25 Indians. There's just not enough judges, and the time it takes for both criminal and civil cases to be decided is just incredibly long. The average time for interim appeals to be decided by the Bombay High Court in the late 90s was 18 years. So 18 years after you first filed a case, you might expect to have an interim judgment on an appeal of the case. The riot cases from 92-93 and the case of the bombings, it's still dragging on through the courts. There still hasn't been a verdict. At the time I was living there, half the judgeships on the Bombay High Court were vacant. The politicians simply won't appoint new judges. So because of this tremendous backlog, what happens if somebody, let's say, you've left your apartment and somebody just moves in, or a tenant refuses to vacate and you sue him in the courts, the case will drag on for years. Adjournments are really easy to get. There's very few court costs associated with filing a lawsuit. So as one of these gang leaders explained to me, if somebody has appropriated your property, go to the courts and it'll take them 10 years. Come to us, it'll take us 10 days. Hmm. We will restore to you what is yours. We will restore to you what you even forgot you owned in the first place.
Hmm. So life in the city of Bombay, in India, it's daily insults and assaults fosters this kind of vigilantism.
Well, it's not like everyday life is like that, because, again, people make their accommodations with the system. They figure out who they can give money to. They're highly suspicious of renting out their properties. You know, it's a system in which people have to live, so somehow they make their accommodations, their adjustments, and they live. But I think what's happening in cities like Bombay is that everyday life is becoming steadily more unpleasant. So it's steadily more unpleasant to try to drive to work. It's steadily more unpleasant to take the train. It's steadily more unpleasant to breathe because the pollution levels are really rising. And all of this speaks to a lack of planning for the city and a lack of implementation of the plans that are already in place. For example, the most prime property in central Bombay is something called the mill lands. Now, this is land where textile mills were built, and textile mills were the economic engine of the city in the 19th century. They are no longer so. So the mills are vacant, they've been shut down, and there is a debate about what to do with this land. I mean, it is an area which could really revitalize the city. You could make a huge public park. It could be devoted to schools, which are desperately needed in the city. You could have hospitals. Instead, it looks like what's going to happen with the mill lands is that row upon row of luxury housing is going to be built because the developers of this luxury housing are politically influential. Unless a city like Bombay has a plan for the future and carries it out, it's going to slowly choke. That is, it's never going to die because it's too vibrant a city for that. But it will lose its best talents. It will lose its capital to other cities in the same country, such as Hyderabad or Bangalore or any of these southern cities who have more visionary leaders. It will lose out to these other centers as jobs and capital move out of the city.
Hmm. We have just a couple of minutes left. I have a listener who's called in from Chicago who would like to speak with you. Our guest this afternoon, Suketu Mehta. He is the author of Maximum City, Bombay Lost and Found. Let's take this call. Listener in Chicago, line 4, go ahead.
Namaste. I'd like to ask you, does the thoughts and views of Mahatma Gandhi still have any bearing in India? He was very, very well appreciated by some of the people who were here in America, Dr. Martin Luther King and others. And is his views still relevant and appreciated and enacted, of course, on nonviolence and protest rather than riot?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I'm myself working on a new translation of Mahatma Gandhi's great autobiography, which is called The Story of My Experiments with Truth. Now, he is Gujarati from the state of Gujarat, just to the north of Bombay, as am I. And, of course, Mahatma Gandhi was the great leader that led the independence struggle. But in his home state, Gujarat, we witnessed in 2002 some of the worst writing in independent India, where essentially under the leadership of the state government, hundreds of Muslims were brutally murdered for the simple reason that they were Muslim. And this is the land of Gandhi. And I was absolutely shocked at the ways in which people in the state of Gujarat not only turned a blind eye to this rioting, but actually re-elected this criminal government. So the legacy of Gandhi is really, it's a very complex question. I mean, if you look at independent India today, you look at all its troubles and its religious rioting, and in Gandhi's homeland, for example, you might be driven to despair. But on the other hand, India has also fared much better than other countries which became independent around the same time. I mean, there's never been any kind of army coup in the country. It's done much better than Pakistan, for example, in this regard. And here is a country which is more than 80% Hindu, but has today a Sikh prime minister, a Muslim president, and an Italian Catholic widow who is leader of the governing coalition. So the way in which Mahatma Gandhi brought independence to us, that is, through this nonviolent way, through mass political mobilization, I think has served the country relatively well. So at least politically, it's done some things right, guided by the vision of the Mahatma.
Mm. There we have to leave it. Thank you so much for sharing your love affair with India and Bombay with us through the book and here this afternoon on the program.
Thanks very much, Philip.
Suketu Mehta, our guest this afternoon in this portion of the program. Look for his book, Maximum City, Bombay, Lost and Found. It is available now in a paperback edition from Vintage Departures. And you'll find Mr. Mehta on the World Wide Web at www.suketumehta.com. 6 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Todd Gleason is here with settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade.
Thanks, Celeste. Thank you, Celeste, from the Chicago Board.
You got to switch your microphone around there, my friend. And I think that's my fault because I moved mic four into mic one's slot.
You know, that's okay. I was just sitting down waiting for the Chicago Board of Trade numbers to finish up. And in fact, they are in front of us for the day.
Okay.
Let's take a look at those numbers. Thanks, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade, wheat futures have finished 3 cents higher in the nearby contract at $3.50 a bushel. And the deferreds month were up anywhere between a penny and 3.5 cents. The complete set of numbers look like this in the wheat pit December contract, $3.50. The final trade for the day up three. The high at 302, the low at 299. March contract to 318, high low at 313.5. Settlement price at 316.75. They were up 3.5 cents. In the May wheat, 326.5, the high, the low at $3.24. Settlement price at 325.5, 2.5 higher. July futures, 335.5, the high, the low at 332.5. Settlement price at 334.5. They were up 2.25. And the September wheat for the day, 343.5 the high, the low at 42. Settlement price at $3.43. They were up 2.5 cents. From the corn pit for the day, it finished like this, all lower. And in fact, December contract was down a half cent, at 1.5 cents rather, at $1.86 and a quarter. A bushel fell to new contract lows and fresh 4-year lows on some renewed technical selling today. That on ongoing concern about the potential drop in the feed demand due to the spread of bird flu, which has been weighing on prices both in the corn pit and in the bean pit at the Chicago Board of Trade. Bean futures were off anywhere between 3 and 4 cents today. Corn finished December contract a penny and a half lower at $1.86 and a quarter, with a high of 87.5 and a low at $1.86. March corn down 1.25 today, 201.75 the high, the low at $2.25. Settlement price at $2.50 for the March contract, and it was off a penny and a quarter. May futures, 210.5 the high, the low at 209. Settlement price there at 209.25. They were down 1.25 for the day, and July futures at 219 high, low at 217.25. Settlement price for that July contract, 217.5. They were down 1.25 today. September futures, 226 the high, rather 228 the high, the low at 26.5. Settlement price at 26.75, off 3/4. In December corn, down a penny for next year, 237. Or rather, 238, the settlement price, the low at 37.75, settlement price at 38, and the high at $2.39.5 for December 2006 corn. December oats now 2.5 cents lower, $1.97 the settlement price, and the March futures down 3.75 at $1.84.5. Once again, they were down 3.75. That December contract, by the way, the $1.97 was the high, the low at 181, settlement price at 181.5. Don't want to get that wrong. They're about, 16 cents apart, $1.81.5 the settlement price. For the Dease oats, they were down 2.5 cents. Soy complex now. January beans, 558.5, the high, the low at 550.5. Settlement price at 554. They were down 4.25. The March futures down 4.25 as well. They had a settlement at 561.5, the high at 65.5, and the low at 58, even for the March soybeans. May futures, 571, the high, the low at 563. Settled at 567.25. They were down 3.75. July futures, a 573 settlement price, down 4.25 cents. The high today at 76.5, the low at 69. And the August soybeans settled like this, 579, the high, the low at 573. Settlement price at 575. They were down 4.5 for the day. September futures off 3.5 cents. The high at 78, the low at $5.74.5. They were down at 76.5 by the end of the day, down 3.5 cents for the SEPs. November futures now, 585.5, the high, the low at $5.79, and the settlement price $5.82.5 a bushel for the November 2006 soybean contract, down 3 cents for the day. December bean meal at 170.30, down 140, the high at 71.70, the low at 68.60. The January meal settled 90 cents lower at $170.80. December bean oil, 21.15, the high, low at 20.93. Settlement price there at 20.95. They were down 20.90, or rather down 29, and the Januaries were off 29 as well at 21.17. Now here's Celeste with the numbers from the Merck.
Okay, January feeder cattle, the high today 117.30, the low 116.60, the settlement 117.20, that up 25. March 115.60, the high 114.70, the low 115.45, the settlement, that up 30. April 113.55, the high 112.90, the low 113.55, the settlement, that up 22.5. December live cattle 92.90, the high 92.57.5, the low finishing at 92.85, that up 10. February 95.25, the high 94.90, the low 95.17.5, the settlement, that down 2.5. December lean hog 62.90, the high 61.85, the low 62.35, the settlement, that down 65. February 67.65, the high 66.62.5, the low, the settlement 66.82.5, that down 92.5. April lean hog 69.